Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads. I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM+ to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.
I remember seeing kids in school, their mothers would like write them notes in their lunch and everything was so perfect. And they'd, you know, come and park hours before they got out of school just to wait to pick them up. But like, you know, my dad, it wasn't like that. He would let me like taste his beer when I was young. And we watched Howard Stern together, and like the Howard Stern on E, like the crazy one. This is Death, Sex, and what? What is it?
Money.
We can't do anything until he kills someone.
The show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot.
Well, I give her an orgasm.
I need to talk about more.
You know, I bet if you told her you'd leave Nick for like $1 million, she would write that check.
I'm Lisa Ling, in for Anna Sale. And when I was asked who I wanted to interview for this episode, there were a lot of reasons that rapper and actor Awkwafina was at the top of my list. Like me, she was raised primarily by her dad. Like my kids, she's of both Chinese and Korean descent. And I absolutely loved watching her in last summer's hit rom-com, Crazy Rich Asians.
Thank you very much for bringing Rachel.
Oh, no worries.
Do you want to stop by for some dinner?
Oh, no, I couldn't impose.
No, it's not a problem.
You know, I had some dinner plans.
Seriously, we've got a lot.
Yeah, I'll fucking come to dinner.
That movie was just one of the things that made 2018 a big year for Awkwafina. She also turned 30. She co-starred in the all-female cast of Ocean's 8, dropped an EP called In Awkwafina We Trust, and hosted Saturday Night Live, only the second Asian-American woman ever to do so.
I'm so stoked to be hosting Saturday Night Live. My name is Awkwafina.
But when she was growing up in Queens, Awkwafina went by her birth name, Nora Lum, and her family was not crazy rich.
My grandma lost her restaurant. She went bankrupt. The electricity got cut off her house. That's why she had to move into Queens to raise me. She would lie awake sometimes and you know, we'd be next to each other. And I asked her, like, what is your only wish, grandma? And she was like, just to be able to pay my bills this month. Like, that's what was her wish. It was something that ate at her. And I remember as a kid thinking that we don't have money. Like, it's not like that.
But money was just one reason why Nora's grandmother moved in. When Nora was only 4, her mother died from pulmonary hypertension, and her dad needed a hand raising his only kid.
My grandma was my mom. She filled that void for me.
Yeah, there aren't a lot of kids today who are being raised just by their dad. So back then, what was that like for you as an only child, Asian kid, being raised by a single dad?
I think that There were certain things that I missed. In many ways, I was raised, you know, like a boy, right? I was taught catch before. I was never given dolls. And I, like, literally, there's pictures of me as a baby playing in a bathtub, and I'm playing with wrestling, like Hulk Hogan, like these little Hulk Hogan figures. Those are my dolls. And I think that it instilled in me, like, a certain confidence that is masculine at its core, like, but not, you know, in the ways that you'd think. But at the same time, I think that you miss out on things. You know, this is a kind of sad story, but I remember this so vividly. At my mom's funeral, my Korean relatives had bought me this, like, beautiful dress to wear, and I just threw the biggest tantrum. I was like, I'm not wearing that. And I showed up in, like, a raggedy old T-shirt and, like, shorts, you know? Weird things like that.
What did you know about your mom? Like, do you actually remember her much?
I do. I remember like little things. I think I can imagine what it would have been like to be raised by her. I think, like duck, like she used to feed me duck when I was a kid. And I was like,
and you're talking about duck, you mean the Korean,
the
rice
the
cake.
Circular rice cakes.
Exactly.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And you know, just, so I remember those things, and she was sick for a lot of the time when I was growing up. Yeah.
Even though your dad, was he born in the U.S.?
He came over very young, like okay. Extremely young.
Okay,
like,
so
like
very, very Western Americanized dad.
Yeah.
But he probably was not as communicative as actual, like, white American guys, right? Because Asian culture in general is pretty closed off and uncommunicative.
Oh, especially with dads. There's always, like, that one dad or grandpa that's, like, holed up in a study and hasn't talked to anybody for, like,
yeah.
days. That was my grandpa. And I think my dad, it wasn't, I don't think, like a way that an Asian grandpa would deal with it, you know?
How did he deal with it?
He talks about it all the time still, you know? Laughs about things. I don't think he ever really got over her, you know? And he would have dreams where she would come back and he would be, like, mad at her.
And did you two talk much about what had happened or talk much about their relationship?
You know, when you're 4 years old, how do you process something like that? So the way that I was able to understand is I was watching Bambi. And, you know, that scene where, you know, like the most horrible scene in Bambi. And there was this silence after he calls. And I remember that silence, like, really spoke to me, just the silence. And that's when I, it really kind of hit me. And I think I internalize it in a lot of ways. But also I think that it affects me every day. When you go through adversity at such a young age, you learn embarrassment. And I think it's embarrassment and humility that really drives humor and in some ways, like, creation, you know? And those feelings I was so in tune with at such a young age. I didn't like crying adults. I didn't want to be the source of, like, why people were crying. You know, I don't want to see, like, family members and just crying and, you know, like, holding a crying adult. It's just, it's not something a kid wants to do, you know? So.
And at what age would you say you kind of realize, like, I need to be funny to get over, like, all the hard shit that I'm experiencing and feeling?
Yeah. 4 or 5.
Well, that's really incredible that at such a young age you recognize that if I'm funny, I don't have to kind of address those emotional issues.
Yeah. I think that I wanted so badly to bring joy. And I really felt validation through bringing joy, through making people laugh, you know? But I think that it directly ties into not wanting to get to the meat. You know, you just want to kind of make it light and, you know, get duck out of there.
Do you think that there's been a benefit for you of being raised by a man and having him kind of raise you like a boy, because that's the only way he knew how to raise a kid?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, and there definitely are benefits. I think that it's just a different kind of support, safety, like a different kind of feeling of your support network, right? You don't have that person to, like, teach you how to do your makeup or, you know, dress or take care of yourself or, you know, how to deal with that. Like, when I first got my period, my grandma, she used to work at the exchange cart department of Stony Brook Hospital and would steal so much. I'm sorry, I don't want her to get arrested, but she was steal. Like, she took it full advantage. And so, you know, first time I got my period, she was like, okay, I have a thing. And it was one of those pads they give to pregnant women after it had a belt.
Such massive
and
things.
I was like, wow, like, you, I have to be belted into this thing, bro. So it was quite an eccentric way of learning how to be a woman.
This podcast is called Death, Sex, and Money.
Oh, great. Awesome. So we're just going to talk about sex now?
Okay, so we're going to talk about sex now.
Okay, great.
Because I wonder who you talked to about sex, you know, because with girls, very often it's kind of the mom's role to talk about sex.
Yeah. Yeah. My dad, like, I wasn't even alluding to the conversation. He just, like, brought it up, like, really randomly. He was like, anything you do, just wear a bag. All right. And I'm like, why use this lingo with me right now?
How old are you? Do you remember?
In my early teens, like 13, 14. I was like, I don't want to hear about it. And then, like, my grandma's whole thing. It always becomes more graphic than I need it to be. It's like, you know, Nora, when I was in China, we didn't have birth control. We didn't have condoms. The moral of the story, don't go to Chinese parents for any sexual advice because it never ends well. It's always weird. It always ends weird.
Well, okay, so you didn't get very productive information about sex. But when did you start, like, I don't know, becoming curious about it or thinking about it? Do you remember those first memories?
I used to think that it was hilarious. Like, you know, in the same way a 7-year-old boy thinks that sex is hilarious. You know, like, I think that more so than sex, it was hitting puberty and realizing that everyone around you was starting to become obsessed with sex. I remember my first day of junior high school, I showed up in, like, an And-One sweatsuit. If you don't know what And-One is, it's, like, this basketball brand. And I remember this also so clearly. A guy came up to me and was like, man, why are you wearing that? You're a girl. And it was the first time that I was ever corrected for what I wore. It was never a thing. And then I realized, like, oh, okay, all right, so now I have to learn how to be a girl. I found a journal that I would write in when I was that age, and I was reading it, and you know, it was cringy, but I like started crying because I remember feeling like so inadequate, you know. And it's not just me, it's like everyone at that age, the inadequacy, the not being sure.
Nora ended up going to LaGuardia Performing Arts High School in New York, and in her free time she rapped and wrote her own songs. It was while she was there, when she was 15, that she started performing under the name Awkwafina. But her dad had concerns about her pursuing a career in the performing arts.
You know, I was a bad high school student. I was a bad kid. So I think he was always really used to the idea that I would let him down in some way. He never wanted me to become rich so he could move in with me or anything like that. He just wanted me to be self-sufficient. And if, God forbid, anything happened to him, then I would be okay.
So after high school, Nora left New York City for SUNY Albany, where she majored in journalism and women's studies. Then she got a job in a publicity firm back in Manhattan. But from the beginning, it wasn't a good fit.
I was diagnosed ADD, ADHD at like 7. The office world, it just was never something I understood how to do. You know, I don't understand how people can just sit there and know what they're doing and have purpose. Like, how's that possible? I to this day don't know what a publicist is. And I was one.
You were working as a publicist or a publicist assistant.
Yeah, right? But, you know, I was bad at my job. I would go to work, I would go home, and then that was my time. And I would get home by like 5 or 6 on the, you know, rush hour. And I would open my computer and I would make beats until 4 in the morning. I'd wake up and then not go to sleep, 6, go to work. That's how much I needed that, because every day I spent wondering, like, what am I doing here? Like, what is this? Why am I so useless? Like, why do I not understand? And so going home and making beats, like, that was me. That was my life.
And then on her 23rd birthday, Nora shot a music video for one of her original songs and put it on YouTube.
My veg, like an operatic ballad. Yo, veg, like grandpa's cabbage. And my veg, effortless. Yo, veg, post ads on Craigslist. My veg.
It's the craziest thing I've ever done. And my boss, you know how they have like obligatory office birthdays. I went in and she was like, oh, so what'd you do for your birthday? And I told her, and then I told her what the video was called, and immediately got this kind of email that, you know, wasn't really malicious in nature, but it was just kind of just like, be careful, you know, be careful what you put on the internet, it stays out there, you know, you don't want to, that kind of email. And it was just a kind of like a slap in the face. Like, if I can't have that, like, what do I have? I have nothing. I have nothing. But then also I forgot to send out the New York Times bestseller list, which is essentially just spam mail to the entire company. So I was really bad at what I was doing, right? And I think that was the last straw. I was like, my vag, New York Times, and then that was it. I really wish that it was a situation where I was like, okay, fine, I quit. But it wasn't. Like, I just got fired.
A genius and a vagina. It's 50 times better than a penis. My vag
got built in. How did that affect you, getting fired?
It traumatized me. I still don't think I'm really that over it. Like, I still think it makes me feel, like, completely inadequate. I don't think I've ever really gotten closure. And I think my dad, at a certain point, he stopped believing, and I think that was the biggest letdown, you know, when he lost hope in me. It was kind of just, like, proof of something that he already knew, that I would not be good at adulting. You know, this is not—I couldn't do it. And then, you know— around that time when I got fired, he would like send me these jobs, and they weren't like lit jobs. They were like meat inspector, air traffic controller, you know, like I don't want to disparage those jobs, but like medium hanging fruits compared to like when you go to law school or something, you know, like a sonogram technician was another one. But which is fine. I actually did apply to become a sonogram technician, I hope that he wanted more for me.
Coming up, Nora hits it big as Awkwafina, and along the way realizes that she's seeing some patterns in her personal life.
A lot of the guys that I've dated have had one celebrity crush, and that was Janine Garofalo. So there's a type, you know what I mean? And I love Janine Garofalo, but you know, that's the kind of guy.
Hey, this is Katie Bishop, one of the producers here at Death, Sex, and Money. And this episode with Lisa Ling and Awkwafina is the kickoff of our 2019 Maternity Leave lineup. It's a series of guest-hosted episodes we're featuring while our regular host, Anna Sale, is out for the next couple of months. We asked a bunch of our favorite former Death, Sex, and Money guests, and some new folks, too, to take a turn in the host chair. You'll also hear from Jason Isbell, Ellen Burstyn, Damon Young, John Cameron Mitchell, and some others, talking with the people they're most curious about. And they're digging into things in life, like death, sex, and money, that don't usually come up in polite conversation.
I weigh myself when I get out the shower,
yep.
And that's how much I weigh.
I mean, my family doesn't ask me for money, but I know that they're struggling.
Just getting sober didn't make me all of a sudden happy. Everything in the world did not change.
Yeah, it doesn't fix you.
And if you're just discovering our show, welcome. If you want to hear more of what we usually do here, check out our episode when we had Lisa Ling on as a guest. She talked about being raised by her dad, dancing on tables during her single days, and going through two miscarriages.
Up until that point, I felt like I could do anything. You know, I'd been such a hard worker all my life, and I thought, well, if I put my mind to anything, I can do it. And so the first time I had a miscarriage, it was just sort of like I felt like I had lost control and that it was my fault and that I did something. And the second time it happened, it just really kind of sort of shook me to the core.
To get a link right to that episode, just text the word LISA to the number 70101. And to hear more of the stories we tell on our show about everything from student loan debt to pornography, make sure you subscribe to Death, Sex, and Money at deathsexmoney.org or wherever you're listening to this episode. Coming up next in the maternity leave lineup, John Cameron Mitchell. He interviews jazz legend Marilyn May about her 80 years in the entertainment business and loving and leaving several alcoholic men along the way.
There was bad stuff going on behind the scenes, you know.
Yeah. Were you a saver? Were you a helper?
Didn't I think I could make him quit drinking? Couldn't I just fix him?
This episode is brought to you by Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he will chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Lisa Ling. After Nora Lum lost her office job, she spent her early 20s going all in on her alter ego, Awkwafina. She kept releasing music and comedy on her YouTube channel, and she covered her bills in Queens by working a series of odd jobs, including one at a vegan bodega. Then, in 2018, everything finally came together in a big way. Ocean's 8 and Crazy Rich Asians made her a movie star. And with all that fame came a lot of money.
Like, I don't splurge on literally anything except for karaoke nights if I'm treating, like, a whole group of friends. I'll drop, like, 3 Gs on a group on a night of karaoke. But, like, for myself, like, no, these pants are from Target, dude. I'm literally wearing Target pants. What my grandma instilled with me with all that money worrying is that, like an anxiety that it's going to be gone.
Does that kind of mentality, do you feel like you need to accept anything that is offered to you?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, I people who don't grow up with a lot, when they start getting opportunities, it's hard for them to say no.
Sure.
Because they don't think that something's going to come along tomorrow.
For the record, I have no problem saying no if it's whack, right? That's the thing. That's where my relationship with money gets weird. It's like, I'm not going to do something that I don't believe in for money. You know, even if I was broke, I wouldn't do that.
Like, what are some of the things that you would never do?
A panty liner commercial, a wrapping lunch lady for, like, a really big brand. A lot of things like that. Like, things that, you know, that just don't make sense. Like, why? You know, but because this is a long game for me. This is a long game. You know, I don't care if I go broke playing the long game in the meantime. I think that when I think about my career, I think 50 steps ahead. I'm not thinking about right now.
I'm sitting across from you wearing your Target track pants.
Yeah.
And I also see these images of you constantly in designer dresses. At what point would you say you kind of like got in touch with that like feminine side of you? Or are you in touch with that?
I'm still not in touch with it. That's long gone. I gave up. Like the tomboy, like I was reading this book and it was like, what do you do with a tom man? What happens when you are a tom man? I think it's a perpetual feeling of difference. Always. When I go out with, like, my friends, like, in K-Town, like, you know, they get all gussied up, and I just don't understand. I can't harness that.
Well, what's that like for guys to date a woman who, in some cases, could be more, like, boyish than they are?
I mean, it's a certain kind of guy, for sure.
And so did how old were you when you had your first—
My first, like—
Relationship, or—
Maybe, like— 16, 17, like high school boyfriend, and then like two other ones that were like really serious.
Do you remember when you first felt love for someone else?
Two different kinds of love. I think I felt like that kind of like that crazy love that like you know you drive in a diaper across the country for, which I don't believe.
I'm not unfamiliar with that kind of love, but
oh, you don't put on diaper and you drive across the country. To make sure that they're not cheating on you. Oh, okay, that's weird. I don't know, that's weird. This is the astronaut lady. You remember the astronaut
yes,
lady?
Yes,
that did
yes,
that?
Yes, 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 yes.
Yeah,
okay,
she did it. There's two kinds of love. That love that I first experienced was not love. It was infatuation. It was like a projection of what you believed is like someone that's totally out of your league, and then you finally got him, and you have to do whatever it takes because, you know, that's not love. That's games. That's mind games. The first time I felt love was probably, you know, like in my last relationship, it was a cooperative thing. It wasn't like, oh, my God, like, I have to make sure I take a bird bath before, like, we, you know, oh, my God, I have to, like, shave my sideburns. Like, it wasn't like that kind. It was like, this is really me. And the feeling of having someone there and like not having to worry about any of that stuff, that was real love to me. And I think that, you know, in the relationship that I'm in now, it's like an unconditional love. It's unconditional. It's there's no airs. There's none of that. And that's love for me. And it's very rare. I haven't experienced it a lot.
I know you recently moved from your beloved New York
to LA.
Oh no. Has your grandma been out to visit?
We're working on it right now. She was like, yeah, I'm gonna come to visit California. I'm so excited, and maybe I'll stay for 3 months. And I was like, what? You know? It's like, damn, you wanna stay for 3 months? Okay, am I open loft? Yeah, that's cool. but you know, at the same time, I don't know.
You can't say no to grandma.
Yeah, you don't say no to that, so.
What does your grandma think of your life now? And what does your dad think of your life now?
They're all about it, man. My dad's such a hypocrite. I call him out all the time. He's so against it. And then he became like the tour manager. I never, like when I, my first tour, he finally got on board and he was like, you know what? I'll be a tour manager. And he would book me on like a flight from like New York to Philadelphia, but like I'd stop in Atlanta on the way and wait there for 4 days. Like those were the flights he was putting me on. And now he just wants to, he wants to be my, like my business manager. And I was like, no. I've seen way too many behind the music stories about like, no. So they're on board. My grandma supported me from day one. She bought me singing lessons. She never, ever told me that a dream was too big, ever. And she always, that same thing that always made me feel weird or out of place, like she encouraged that. She knew that was what made me special.
What does it mean to you, you know, given where you are now, that you had this woman who was in your corner, who was like rooting for you and who knew that you could achieve whatever you wanted to achieve?
Mm-hmm. I think that it, in a combination of that and being raised by my dad, I was never introduced to any kind of role of the Asian stereotypical woman's place, because my grandma was not any of those. My grandma was the neck of my family, the financial neck of my family for a long time. My grandma worked 4 jobs while my grandpa was out gambling, you know? I only knew of an Asian woman being a strong woman. And my grandma taught me that.
That's Nora Lum, a.k.a. Awkwafina. She's currently working on a Comedy Central pilot about her life growing up in Queens, and you can also see her in her first dramatic role in a great movie called The Farewell. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. The team includes Katie Bishop, Annabelle Bacon, Emily Botine, and Andrew Dunn. The Reverend John Delore and Steve Lewis wrote the theme music. I'm on Twitter at Lisa Ling and also on Instagram at Lisa Lingstagram. New episodes of my show, This Is Life, are coming to CNN this fall, and you can find past episodes right now at cnn.com/thisislife. If you're not subscribed to this show, Death, Sex, and Money, make sure you hit that subscribe button because it is a really good podcast. And if you don't know where to start, they've even got a starter kit of some of their favorite episodes just for you. Find it at deathsexmoney.org. I want to go back to something I read, and this is way back, and I know it's a little bit of a tangent.
But, yeah.
You know, I know that you went to LaGuardia School of Performing Arts for trumpet.
Yeah.
And is it true that you chose trumpet because it was like a loud instrument?
It's the loudest in the band. I don't want a piccolo. Yeah, like what?
Why am I not shocked?
No, but also, you know what? I was a ham, and we played Live and La Vida Loca, and I got yelled at by my band teacher because I wouldn't let the woodwind shine. And I was like, Live in La Vida Loca is like the brassiest song you could ever choose. Woodwinds have no place in this song, right? Shut up. Let me shine.
I'm Lisa Ling, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.